Welcome to another edition of Global Conversations. My guests tonight, two friends returning to talk about China, Jeff J. Brown and Eric Arnault. Jeff is in Normandy. Eric is coming to us from Thailand. Welcome, friends.
Thank you.
So I'm really excited about what we're going to be talking about today, but I first need to start with Joe Biden's recent trip to Japan and South Korea, where he really upped the ante with more threats to China. He's got Japan and South Korea firmly in America's camp to combat China in any way they can. So I want a comment from both of you. What do you make of Biden going there at this particular time when the United States has been threatening China over Taiwan, and at a press conference, Biden was asked directly, would you defend, really go to war against China if China tried to take back Taiwan? He said yes. Jeff, I'm going to start with you.
I think it's mainly just red meat for to satisfy American voters. You know, there's their elections are coming up this fall, and he needs to look tough and resolute. The United States couldn't even, you know, win in Korea. They couldn't win in Vietnam. They couldn't win in Afghanistan. They couldn't win in Iraq. They're not winning in Syria. And China is not Grenada or Panama. It's just ridiculous. And the supply lines from the West Coast of the United States all the way to China are thousands and thousands and thousands of kilometers. China is just, you know, less than 2,000 kilometers away. Mainland China is less than 2,000 kilometers away from Taiwan. They've got bases in the South China Sea. Most people don't even know that the U.S. naval fleet in the South China Sea has to stay more than 1,500 kilometers away from the Chinese coast in order to not be wiped out by Chinese aircraft carrier killer missiles. Yet, the planes on those aircraft carriers can only go 500 kilometers out and 500 kilometers back. They can't even go to China. So it's just absurd. And it's just, I think America knows, the Joint Chiefs of Staff know they would just get their clocks cleaned, and China would overwhelm them with all of their hypersonic missiles, and their Navy is, you know, now better than the U.S.'s. They've got 10 times more ships, you know, surrounding Taiwan. It's a pipe dream. It's just ludicrous for PR and to make America, you know, look like, you know, the imperial globocop that it wants to project around the world.
Okay, Eric, your thoughts on that meeting and that time in Japan and South Korea?
Well, you know, as Jeff says, America has a self-image that it's a legend in its own mind at this point. You know, it's been kicking the rest of the world around for decades. And, you know, one of the strangest thing is that you've got South Korea, and who are South Korea's biggest enemies? Japan and the United States. Those were the two countries that just totally ruined that country, killed millions of people, enslaved them. And yet somehow it's nice that you can be friends again, but why pick a fight with somebody who didn't do that to you? You know, it's ridiculous. And Japan has become, you know, I think it's the Stockholm syndrome, you know, where you internalize your oppressor. Not that Japan is any kind of innocent. They've been guilty of all kinds of crap, and their government is out of control. You know, their government has been run by fascists, you know, forever, basically, with small interludes. They got their lesson. They got their clock cleaned in World War II, and there was a peace movement. But these kinds of movements are being crushed. And you talk to the average South Korean. When I've actually met some South Koreans here in Thailand, and you know, America's great to them. You know, they just really don't get it. You know, as far as Korea is concerned, I think you know, China's afraid of these THAAD missiles, which are you know, anti-missile missiles, which would supposedly you know, make possible at first strike. And Regis, as you've pointed out, Jeju Island, and there are military bases that have missiles that probably could reach China. So China is certainly, it's not like they don't have anything to worry about, but you know, as Jeff says, they're limited. What they can do in Taiwan, you know, I just read an article, I think it was in Global Times, and they're saying that, you know, somebody, one of my Russian correspondents sent me an article saying that the United States would rather destroy Taiwan because of its massive semiconductor capacity. Both the United States and China depend on their semiconductors, and the United States thinks that if they can foment a war, it'll hurt the US, but it'll hurt China more. I mean, how self-defeating can a policy be? The whole political class in the United States has gone crazy.
Well, you mentioned a couple of things I want to talk about just a little bit. Both Japan and South Korea really are occupied nations.
Right.
I've been to both. Mm-hmm. I've been to Okinawa. The United States has somewhere around 40 bases in each country, 40 military bases with tens of thousands of troops. Okay. So you made a very good point on that. These are not independent countries. Their defense and their economy completely has depended on the United States. The United States rebuilt both of those countries. The second thing you mentioned, Eric, very important, 90% of the semiconductor industry in the world is manufactured in Taiwan. They have the latest and greatest and fastest semiconductors. Jeff, I'm going to throw it back to you, and you can comment on either of that, but China and the United States are so entangled. China is holding enormous American debt. America shipped all of our manufacturing there, Vietnam, I don't know, Thailand, Singapore, wherever. And everything we buy or they buy in America is made there. Jeff, your thoughts on this entanglement and what's really going on with this impending conflict with China?
The current situation is that the United States wants to destroy China. This is the, you know, Western leadership. They have reptile brains. They can't think beyond trying to consume all of their enemies. The thought of cooperating with anybody is beyond their comprehension. So China has a bigger economy. They are the world manufacturing base. They are the world's logistics and shipping power for the world. They are technologically incredibly advanced. So China is the ultimate target. When they were talking back during the Truman Eisenhower era, you know, who lost China, they They have never accepted the fact that China is now an independent, free, unoccupied country, and not only that, but a colossally big economic engine for the world, and their military is now on, I think, better than the United States is. So that's why the U.S. is in the Ukraine right now, and Europe are in Ukraine, that because they cannot destroy. And we talked about this the last time we were together. They cannot destroy China with Russian solidarity, and so they've got to get rid of Russia first, which is not going to work. I mean, the whole Ukrainian thing is just falling apart at the seams. It's just pathetic to see. Again, Russia is not Panama and Grenada. So it's just not going to work. As Eric says, it's very important for an imperial power to look invincible. So there's a lot of optics, there's a lot of propaganda, there's a lot of PR to project invincibility, supremacy, total control over the world. But as the three of us know, and I think many of the fans out there who are watching us know, this whole colonial and then after World War II Bretton Woods system of dominating the planet's natural and human resources is just falling apart at the seams. And I think the U.S. will just continue to bluster and bluster and bluster. If they did something that would cause the Chinese to have a war with China while they're having a war in the Ukraine, it would be over in a month in Taiwan. I mean, they would just overwhelm the island, and there'd be nothing we've also talked about that. Would the West resort to nuclear arms to avoid defeat? That's the $64,000 question.
Okay, Eric, you take this one first, and then we'll come back to Jeff.
Okay.
While Biden was in, I think it was South Korea, the Russians and the Chinese held a joint military operation. And they were flying their long-range bombers, along the South China Sea. I don't know if it was the Sea of Japan. What do you make of that particular operation, Eric?
Well, you know, I was just watching a news report, and I'm watching reports about what's going on in Ukraine, which I follow quite closely as well. And, if you look at the trajectory, you know, you had Vietnam failed. We did have a big win in Grenada. We did destroy Yugoslavia, but Russia started wising up, and they intervened in Syria, and the U.S. is essentially lost in Syria, and they've lost in Afghanistan, and so they decided, okay, well, we lost there, so let's try failing upward and go after Russia. So they pick a fight with Russia in Ukraine, and from everything I'm hearing, they're failing there. So the news reports are downplaying. They're like not reporting as much on Ukraine. Well, everybody, we got you all hyped up about Ukraine, the Russians, evil Russians. Well, but we're losing, so we better not talk about that. Let's go to Japan and South Korea, and let's foment something there. If we can't beat Russia, let's take on China. They're failing upward, and there's nowhere for them to go. So Russia and China are saying, America, with these jets flying. They're saying, America, don't even think about it.
All right. That's they sent a message to America, don't even think about it. Jeff, your take on that.
Well, this is like diplomatic tit for tat. You know, France sends home 10 Russian diplomats. So Russia sends home, 10 French diplomats. Militarily, the Chinese and the Russians need to do the same tit for tat. A lot of people forget, Russia has a huge amount of real estate in the Pacific and all the way down to the Kuril Islands, just north of Japan. So they have to do the same thing. And so the United States keeps egregiously with the French and the British and the Australians, keep encroaching in Chinese territory with their ships and their airplanes, just to upset them and show again invincibility, and we can stay. Again, this is PR optics and propaganda for red meat for the conservative and liberal. Liberals love war back in America. Mm-hmm. They're more warmongers than the conservatives. So it's just to show the the might of the United States. And so the Chinese and the Russians have to do the same thing, and they've got to do a flyby, just as sort of the line in the sand, and stepping across it and showing that they're there, they know what's going on, and we are ready for you. If you ever decide to keep flying, towards the mainland, or keep flying towards the Russian Russia's territory in the Pacific.
Yeah, I like what Eric said. Don't even think about it. All right, we're going to change the subject here, but we're staying on China. Guys, I've wanted to ask you this question because you both have lived in China. You both know China quite well. You know the region. Well, the thing that was on everybody's tongues and in everybody's minds was this whole idea of this social credit system in China. It's got people in the West, trembling. This is complete government domination and control. I've read where the Chinese apparently love it. It's also eliminated a great deal of crime and corruption. Jeff, coming to you first. Tell me what you know about this social credit system. And I would assume you're going to tell me from the point of view of the Chinese as a culture, as a people.
Absolutely. I'm going to probably take a few minutes to explain all this because we really need, China with 5,000 years of history, you can't just jump into the social credit system. You really have to understand the background. And we need to realize that China has always been the complete opposite of what the big lie propaganda machine in the West projects onto the people. China has always been small government for the people. China has always had the Chinese government has always believed in minimum interference in their daily lives. It is consensual, consultative, local rule, low taxes on the people. The wealthy are expected to help take care of the people, which is, of course, very Buddhist. Low tariffs, free markets. And the Chinese and the government have a huge mutual trust with each other. And this comes from Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism. This idea that the social credit system is some sort of Orwellian, octopus is garbage. For thousands of years, the Chinese have had a local community responsibility system where 10 households get together, every 10 households get together, and they are self-administered, and it's a group responsibility. So if some guy in your 10 households steals somebody's food or steals something or causes a fight or whatever, It doesn't, it's all handled locally with the local magistrate, but there is group responsibility. There's collective responsibility. Those 10 households suffer the consequences. So there's a tremendous, the one word that the West does not like and Westerners do not like is accountability. And that is what the Chinese have always been about, is accountability, social, community, and individual. And this turns everything on our heads. The West has always been big, aristocratic, controlling government over the people, authoritarian, tyrannical rule. I mean, you think of ancient Greece, Rome, the Catholic Church, kings, queens, nobles, and big businesses. And this obsession that the Western elites have to control their people, you know, is summarized. There's a guy from the 18th century Britain called Jeremy Bentham. He was a philosopher, and he came up with the idea of creating a prison, a circular prison, where a watchtower was put in the middle of the prison so that one guy could watch everybody in the prison simultaneously. So it's not China. It is the West that has always been very top down, chain of command, national rule, high taxes on the people, low taxes on the elites to protect them, high tariffs to protect the elite owners, mutual fear, not mutual trust, but mutual fear between the government and the people. And we have a social credit system in Europe and in the United States. In the United States, we have Equifax and TRW, big faceless private corporations who keep my information. They sell it to, I don't know who they're selling it to. I don't know who they're giving it to. I have to pay money to see my own credit score. You get something wrong on your credit score in the United States, just try to get it removed and just see how easy it is. It's almost impossible. You know, the United States is imprisoning people for debt, personal debt and traffic tickets, you know, secret no-fly lists. We know that the deep state is vacuuming, sucking up every phone call, every text message, every credit card payment, everything that we do is known. No one talks about that. As you said, everybody talks about, oh, the Chinese social credit system. So this is the worst, you know, Western psychological deflection of its totalitarian system onto China's millennial people's democracy. Let me tell you a little bit about why the social credit system came into existence. And I'm sorry, Eric, I know you, this is a three-way deal, but I really want to explain this because this is one of the most absurdly misunderstood things. During the Mao era, there was no crime, no drugs, no prostitution, no gambling, no loan sharking, no mafia, no nothing. There was no crime during the Mao era up until about 1980. Then during Deng's deregulation and reforms, he basically let loose the dogs of street level jungle capitalism. And it was not a nice place to live. My wife and I lived there from 1990 to 1997, and it was dog eat dog. Nobody trusted anybody. It was just pure street level jungle capitalism. You're just ripping people off. It was awful. It got a little bit better later on, but it was when Xi got elected president in 2012 that he came up with the idea of this social credit system. And I think it should be called the social harmony system. And it was demanded by the Chinese people. The Chinese people insisted on something because it had just gotten completely out of control at the daily, you know, street level, a lot of corruption, government corruption, military corruption. It had just gotten awful. So and what's cool about the social credit system, and I'm going to call it the social harmony system because I think it's the best name, it's totally open. It's totally free. everybody has access to everything. In fact, I can show you right here, or I'll just show you. I may have to start over. Hang on just a second. Here is my credit score on Alipay. Here it is right here. I have a credit score of 600, if you can see that, 633, and it says it's good. It's not great, but it's good. Okay. Anybody who wants to ask, in fact, I think it was Eric that was saying, you know, I was wanting to do business with this guy, but I don't know anything about him. You know, is he a crook? Well, in China, that's not a problem. You just say, what is your national ID number? And then you put it into the social credit system and you can see what this guy's score is. And my wife and I had a limited liability company in China, and anybody who wanted to do business with us could check out our score. Anybody, it's free. And if I feel like it, I have been wronged, that something's wrong, they have an online arbitration dispute system where you can get stuff removed if it's not true. If a guy's a crank and is complaining about people erroneously, he's going to get his social score crushed. So it's accountability. And it goes, the main focus of the social harmony system is corporations, businesses, business people, and government workers and government bureaus. They all have a social score. So if you are a corrupt government official, your social score is going to be in the dirt, and thousands, as Regis has talked about, thousands and thousands and thousands of corrupt business people, government workers, government leaders, party members have been punished because of the social harmony system. The people love it, and it's totally transparent, it's totally free. And people who have a good score above 750, I'm not there yet, 750, you know, they get concessions on loans and education and public housing and reservations and plane tickets and visas. If you have a bad score, well, your company will not be allowed to issue corporate bonds. They can't get bank credit. They can't, you know, their name's going to be put on a blacklist of all the corrupt corporations that have bad scores in the country. All those scores are available. Deadbeats who don't pay alimony, who don't pay their debts, they're on that list. Who would not want this? Who would not want this? And it's free, and there's no profit involved in it, and it's all being managed by the people and determined by what the people want and expect. I love it. I recently had an unfortunate situation where I got ripped off in China. I was able to, you know, use the credit system to make a complaint about this person. So I think it's terrific. We already have one that's private, secret, nefarious. No one knows what's going on behind, you know, the doors of our social credit system. And China's is all out there for the people to decide and to control. Thank you.
Wow.
Jeff, I'd like to ask you a question about this because, you know, people can default on a loan or whatever, but there may be extenuating circumstances. You know, they may lose a job or something like that, or they could get sick and they can't work. So how do they protect their social score when it's not?
Well, you know, the we're not talking about a guy who's bank debt like that in China, they go out of their way. The banks go out of their way not to default on people. You have to be in a real, you have to either be a big time crook. They don't foreclose on a house after you don't make a payment for 2 months or 3 months. I mean, they work with people. They have a tremendous social responsibility not to put people on the street. So they will go out of their way to help people not lose a house, et cetera. They will talk to the other family members. What can we do to make this work? It's not like in the United States where they're just, you know, sitting there salivating, waiting for you to default so that they can seize your property. I've never heard of that happening. What I hear is people who are blatantly not paying debts, you know, and we're not talking about a house. We're talking about millions, you know, hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars, business people, small businesses, corporations, polluters, people polluting, violating environmental laws. I don't even know if you weren't able to pay for your house, I think there would be so much social pressure not to report you on the social credit system, unless you prove to be just an out and out thief, because they just, you know, Eric, I mean, you're a Buddhist and you lived in, traveled in China, you know how they are. They're very Buddhist. They're very Confucian and practice the golden rule. The ethical golden rule. This is meant to punish people who are screwing the system and screwing the people. That's what it's all about.
Eric, one of the things that people in the West and America complain about China and this system is that it's communist. They're communists. What are your thoughts about communism from your understanding in China?
That's an interesting question. I don't really know how to answer it, to be honest with you. I'll illustrate it, I guess, by a story. At one point, I was introduced to the police chief of the city of Xiamen. And he's, a high-ranking Communist Party official. He also happened to be a sculptor. He was a retired police chief. You know, what is your vision of what a police chief is? This guy was creating environmental sculpture in his spare time. So I met him, and through an interpreter, we had this conversation. And he said, what do you think of Marx? Interesting for a police chief to ask a question like that. And I said, well, you know, in America, Marx is considered kind of the devil. So we're not really allowed to think about him at all. But my understanding of communism is that everybody is treated and resources are treated fairly. Now I'm practicing as a Buddhist, and the primary directive in Buddhism is to save all beings. So I don't see any contradiction between the two. You know, they're basically two ways of describing the same thing. You're in a society, nobody's left out, people are taken care of. So that is my understanding of communism as a system. And granted, there have been cases, you know, corruption occurs, it doesn't matter what the country or what the political system is, but the basic idea of it, and you know, you look at the history of China, and this is the main thing. Here's this country It had not one, but two Holocausts, one in the 19th century where it lost upwards of 20 million people in a world war, in a civil war, fomented essentially from the outside. And then World War II, again, invaded by the Japanese, another 20 million people died. The country is on its flat on its back. The life expectancy is like 40 years old. And under that terrible person, Mao, by the time he died, the life expectancy was like 70 years old. So they had to have been doing something right. And then as China shifted towards a kind of a mixed economy, the life expectancy has increased even more and the wealth has increased dramatically. So it seems to be working there. I mean, if you look at what's going on in China in terms of personal wealth compared to what's going on in the West and in Europe, there's no comparison. What's not working? It looks like to me like capitalism isn't working. Communism seems to be working in its iteration in China. So that would be my response.
Yeah. And Jeff, when you were describing this long history of China and Chinese culture as being very communal, very local, people looking after each other, I was thinking the whole time while you were talking about that, that's communism. That's mm-hmm. the community comes first, mm-hmm. and people mm-hmm. looking after each other and the government looking after the people. Mm-hmm. And you have to say, what is wrong with that? So Jeff, where does the stigma come from? Does it come from Mao? Does it come from Stalin? That, you know, where does it come from?
You know, this goes all the way back to, I mean, this has been going on for, I think, 5,000 years around the world where elites want to exploit the 1% wants to exploit the 99%. I don't think that much has changed in 5,000 years of history. But I think the Chinese have been much, much better off than the West. Because the Western system serves the 1% corrupt elite aristocratic, you know, I mean, they're tyrannical. I mean, there's you know, for every Franklin Roosevelt or Abraham Lincoln or Charles de Gaulle or Napoleon, or, you know, Caesar was actually a populist. That's why they killed him, because he was actually helping the little guy, the 99%. For every one of those, we've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of despots and tyrannical dictators for the most part. So it's just, you know, we have Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism on one side based on the ethics of the Golden Rule. And we have on the other side 1% elite, tyrannical, greedy, you know, kleptocratic elites who want to exploit everything they can get their hands on the other. So, of course, they don't like the Chinese system. Of course, they don't like communism, because communism is the antithesis of capitalism and individual personal enrichment. So in my book, The Big Red Book on China, you open it up on the first page and there's a picture of Marx, Karl Marx, and there's a picture of Emperor Shang from 1500 BC, who's considered, although they had many before that, he was considered to be like the first real, you know, nominated, named emperor. And I said, you know, there's no difference between them. The Chinese have always been very communistic. And it's not just the Chinese. Most of the world, the natives all over the Americas, the natives all over South America, Africans, Asians, Aborigines, most of them, the vast majority of them, were communist in the sense of, as you said, sharing, helping each other, you know, watching each other's back, communal land, sharing tools and things like that, and sharing, you know, and the work. This has been this, you know, the West, you know, the tiny, you know, tip of Eurasia, which later, you know, expanded into North America. It just is so such a tiny percentage of the people. But if you ask most Westerners, you know, that's the only way, it's the only way the world can work. And it's, you know, when I think about DPRK, North Korea and Venezuela and Cuba and Bolivia and Ecuador and Argentina and Peru and the Caribbean countries and African countries like Mozambique and Angola, who have been, have had war declared on them, total war declared on them by Western global capitalism as soon as they announced their intentions to be something other than a prostitute for Western capitalism. Indonesia, you know, with, you know, obviously tried with Sukarno. And so Vietnam, you know, Cambodia, Laos, I mean, there's so many of them. And Eric can tell you, the Thai royalty, they don't like communism, but they take care of their people. You know, they really try to take care of their people. So that is a royal government that actually works for the people. So it's just the elites control the media. We've been brainwashed from the womb that communism is evil, socialism is evil. It's in our churches, it's in our schools, it's in our advertising, it's in our movies, it's in our books, it's in our textbooks. And we just cannot see what these countries have done and what they are doing, because we've just been blinded by the big lie propaganda machine that it is utter evil. I don't know if I ever told you all, I think I may probably told Eric when we were living together, you know, in the same city, Chiang Mai in Thailand, but my daughter was here a couple, three years ago, and we were in Paris and you know, Champs-Élysées and having a coffee, and you would think, you know, she was coming back from China. And after she had been here for about 2 or 3 weeks for summer vacation, and she sat there, and here we are, like in one of the most highly sought after locations in the world, the Champs-Élysées in Paris in summer. You know, it was just beautiful. And she said, you know, Daddy, it's really weird. I actually feel more free in China than I do here. And she's right. Once you live in a country like that, where you have safety and protection and mutual benefit and mutual help and mutual aid and solidarity, you know, with your neighbors and with your community and with your government, when you have that, that's real freedom. That's real freedom. And so I think it's very telling that my daughter actually, you know, said that, you know, as a real life experience.
So, you know, Jeff, as you were talking about all this, it occurred to me that one of the main reasons why there has been this constant hostility towards communism is because the, as you say, the people who run things have a psychological disorder, basically what it boils down to. They're extremely isolated psychologically. They're brought up in a way where there's so much emphasis on the ego in Western culture and this idea of me against the world, that when you get into those upper levels of the hierarchy, these people have clawed their way to the top or were born on third base and thought they hit a triple, that the idea of equality or communism or fairness in an economic system is extremely threatening to them, because they could live quite happily on a nest egg of $50 million, but they need to have $3 billion or even $1 trillion in order to feel good about themselves. And anybody who says that that's not true is an attack on their sense of self, which is it's almost like an existential threat to them, because they conflate this this self-conception with their physical existence. It's really pathetic, but that's how it is, and that's why we see these this demonization. In preparing for this, I looked up the issue of human rights abuse, and there's some website, I think it's called the Foundation for the Memorial of Communist Abuse, or something like that. I don't remember. It's a U.S. government funded foundation, and of course Adrian Zenz is one of the researchers, and it's obviously, you know, a cutout for U.S. propaganda. And one of the things they say is, we're here to memorialize the 100 million people who died as a result of communism. And I just thought, only 100 million compared with 5 centuries of genocide? And does that count the 27 million Russians that were killed during World War II, or the 3 million Russians who were killed after the revolution when it was invaded, or the 500,000 Cambodians, or 500,000 Laotians, or the 3 million Koreans, or the 4 million Vietnamese? What are we talking about here? But they're so obsessed with the idea of demonizing that which challenges their worldview that they simply can't. They just have to be on this constant war, mental war attack. It's pathetic, but that's how it is.
We're going to segue now to the question of human rights. The United States, guilty more than any other country on the planet ever of violating human rights, is throwing stones, accusations against all kinds of other countries that they want to take down. They did it with Russia. They're doing it with Russia. They're doing it with China. And the thing that they always throw out, the American side, is that the Chinese are persecuting other religions and the I don't know how you pronounce this, Uyghurs?
Uyghur.
I'm coming to you first, Jeff. Tell me about that. Is that a reality? I've seen reports that it's absolutely not true.
It's absolutely not true, and I even wrote about it. Internal Department of State documents from the U.S. Embassy in Washington, the U.S. Embassy in Beijing and Washington, even say it's not true. They know it's not true. They know it's a big lie propaganda cudgel to destroy the image of China around the world. I have been to Xinjiang. I know many Uyghurs. It's just a load of complete fabrication. It's the big lie. They National Endowment for Democracy, the CIA, Soros, and all the others, you know, pay millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars for people outside of China to write basically just lies. And the big lie that came out a couple of years ago was this Uyghur group which is basically they're just whores and trolls for the CIA, came out and said that there were concentration camps in Xinjiang. Well, it's just a million, and then 2 million, and the number just kept going up, and this takes traction because the mainstream media and the West just regurgitates this stuff and doesn't even and they don't want there they don't want to even know the truth. It is, first off, I've traveled through most of China's minorities areas. They're spoiled rotten. They get whatever they want. They have privileges that the majority Han people could only dream of. They have exceptions for this and exceptions for that, and they get this help and they get that help, and they get help with their language and they get help with everything. You know, Tibet and Xinjiang are spending billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars in those two provinces to help the people. It's just utter garbage. But you know what? It works because CNN says it's true. The Economist says it's true. The New York Times says it's true. Fox News says it's true. The Washington Post says it's true. And all the other languages in Europe say that that with their media, French, German, et cetera, they just rewrite the same script. It's all true. It's on TV, so it must be true. And it's just a load of bunk. But this is how the United States, with their lizard brains, you know, the West, they've got lizard brains. They can only think about destroying their enemy. They cannot think of anything other than total destruction. And right. The idea of mutual benefit and win-win. Well, no wonder all these countries want to work with China, because China is win-win mutual benefit. And which is very Confucian, Taoist, and Buddhist. You know, it's just very, very much the golden rule. And so it's just not true. I mean, what would China do with 2 million? It's like something like 20% of the population and they're in concentration camps. It's just junk. I had Uyghur neighbors in Beijing. We had a mosque. 2 minutes from our house. The whole block next to us was full of Uyghurs. wonderful people, great food, nice, you know, great business people. It's just garbage, but garbage sells. And, you know, and that kind of ran its course. That didn't work for a while. I mean, finally it petered out. And so now we're back to Russia, 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 you know, Russia, 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 Russia. And they'll eventually try. Tibet was a huge failure. It's going great guns. Xinjiang is going great guns. So it's just, you know, the West is like a gigantic howitzer of hate. And all they can do is point that howitzer in one direction and just bomb the crap out of whoever they want to try to destroy. Today it's Russia. And then they'll eventually get, that's not going to work. And then they're going to move to China. And then they're going to move to DPRK. And they're going to move to Venezuela. It's just a howitzer of hate. And that's the only way that they can deal with 85% of the world's people.
Right. Jeff, I want to
finish with you. Your thoughts on human rights issues in terms of suppression of religion in China.
Yeah, well, just took the words out of my mouth. Now, I have not, you know, I went to China specifically because I come from a Zen background, and Zen came from China, not from Japan. It actually came from China, and all the stories that we used to read, they're all about Chinese guys, and there are all these famous Zen masters, and I wanted to visit their temples. And of course, from what most Buddhists in America and in the West think, and I should address this to all of you who are listening, you think that Buddhism is completely suppressed in China. Now, it is true that during the Cultural Revolution, there was suppression of Buddhism in China. And but you know, Zhou Enlai was a disciple of Shuyun, the great Zen master who lived for to be 120 years old. And Mao, when he was talking with Zhou Enlai about him, said, gee, this guy sounds really great. I'd like to be a student too. Well, they never actually did meet, but that was that sentiment. Flash forward after the Cultural Revolution, there was a huge move towards rebuilding many of these temples. And I visited these temples, and Regis, I've sent you pictures of me taking pictures of abbots of a number of these places. And these are like the most famous temples in Zen history. These are the stories that I was like my mother's milk as a Zen student when I was first starting. So I'm at these temples, and one of them, there was one particular abbot specifically that I asked, and I said, you know, what's going on with Buddhism? Is there a lot of meditation going on in China now? And he said, a lot. And what that means to me is that there's two cases in point. One is he's the abbot of one of the most famous temples in China. And he's also a member of the Chinese legislature. Another fellow that I met is both a member of the Communist Party and a Buddhist. And I said, I thought that was, it's not, you can't do that. He says, no, it's okay. So obviously, what China doesn't want, and it's totally legitimate, is they don't want these interlopers coming in from outside to sow dissent and screw the society up and stage a color revolution. That's what they don't want. And they're not going to put up with that crap. But as long as you know, practice your religion and you're not messing around trying to cause trouble, you can do what you want.
So, Eric, what about interlopers from the West, Catholicism, the Methodists, Lutherans? Are they tolerated in China, or are they considered these interlopers that are coming in to mess up the people and the culture?
Well, I'm not Chinese. I haven't met many of these people. I do know a couple of Christians, and they are, you know, against the government on principle for some reason. And, you know, we get along, but we don't really talk about stuff like that. I don't know very many of them. I guess all I would say is that if they act in ways that are going to be disruptive, then it's going to be a problem. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you're in the West, I used to belong to the Rotary Club, and we'd have these discussions. They bring in these speakers, and these speakers were usually representing the status quo. One particular speaker came in from he was from PG&E, the California Energy Company, the California Electric Utility. And he was talking about this great new restructuring program. So I asked him, well, you built that nuclear power plant on the coast with the blueprints backward, which resulted in a $2 billion mistake. And this restructuring is basically getting the ratepayers to pay for your corporate mistake. The room exploded. Not at him, but at me. And there were several other examples where I would raise these kinds of issues. And later on, a woman took me aside and said, you know, Eric, you're not so popular here because you're too political. So talk about repression. You know, that's the big, this is what's so crazy about Western culture. So they say, oh, those guys are repressive. We're free. but people are not free. There's no intellectual freedom in the United States. If you don't, cancel culture is the ultimate social credit system. It's completely repressive. It's flat out totalitarian, and nobody wants to talk about it. You know, oh, but it's China. Oh, but it's Russia.
Well, guys, I want to thank you again very much for a very enlightening and inspiring conversation. We'll be doing it again shortly.